fall fundraising campaign. It's your radio station, and we look forward to receiving your financial contribution at www.ciut.fm. Thank you in advance.
Proudly student and listener-supported community radio. CIUT 89.5 FM, the sound of your city.
Good morning. Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And, well, it's been a long weekend, hasn't it? What is it? It's a, you go seven games, World Series, you go into extra innings, seventh game, and somebody has to lose and it turned out bad for our side, but it's almost some sort of fate. We lose the ball game, and they set the clocks back, and it becomes dark and cold. it's like purgatory, peculiar. I think that, like everybody else, I have to account for my focus. I believe like everyone else, hanging on every pitch and trying to outmanage the manager and wondering where so-and-so is. But I think we have to say that about the Blue Jays, that you're going to remember this series for sure. And you're going to have to, in years come, as years pass, it's going to be called the Jays of 25. There should be a book. There was once a book called The Boys of Summer. It was about, one season. As a matter of fact, it had to do with the Dodgers. But there's a combination of people, combination of personalities, and where the fan, those watching or following them, notice that there is some, it's not just hype about the chemistry of a team, of a group of athletes. And you, because sports has it's just tons of cliches and there's rhetoric. I think all of us, by the way, watching all these ball games, now we can all say, list language that we have to use in certain situations. Ball players always do say, well, you know, we like each other, we never quit. Every team that's ever been interviewed, any member always say, we never quit and we always fight and blah, blah. But meanwhile, in fact, this team was remarkable, and they played varieties of baseball. They could knock the ball out of the park, but they could also play what's called small ball. There's been some very successful championship teams that played small ball and bring down the Giants, you know. And in this one, you have to say that the scoreboard didn't show it, but they won as well or as much as their opponent. And nobody can laugh them off or say they didn't have what it took. They got it. And they're the American League champions. They knocked off the New York Yankees, which really is the big test for if you're in the American League. They knocked off the Yankees, who had every kind of million-dollar talent, too. And they beat the Mariners. And if listeners don't remember it, both those teams were in our way in the past, and the Jays had problems getting past the Mariners. It was considered some sort of curse, but they took care of that. And by the way, in the case of the Yankees and the Mariners, they had super home run people. The Mariner catcher, who I happily forget his name, except he's called the I hate to say this, the big dumper, and don't ask where he got that name. But at any rate, he's a home run champion. We beat his club and him. So, yeah, it's going to be, in my opinion, to be the Jays of 25. And people will say, oh, you remember Clement? You remember this? And they'll remember the ball players who were not supposed to be or weren't regarded as the marquee players. They were the guys that we all came to know because we were watching them and we saw what they would do. Guys who could come in and pinch hit, guys who could pinch run, people who come in on defense. So we know them. And actually, people who watch this series know of them. That leads, of course, to our winter problem. We're going to we're going to have a long, bitter winter thinking about these things. But of course, what we all would like to see is an assemblage of players like those of 25. But when 26 rolls around, we're going to be very nervous because the world has discovered we've got some really nice ball players here and who've been working for maybe a little less than they might have gotten. And that's one of the things that happens in all sports, is that a team basically comes out of nowhere. I mean, we had once been in last place, and we ended up in first in this season. And it becomes all the predators show up and say, I'd like to have that one, and I'd like to have this one, and can you match me? And the team that's a champion team finds it very hard to hold on to their players. But that's for I used to call it the hot stove league or whatever it was, where people would chew on baseball until spring, chew on the subject. Anyway, the Jays is 25, bless their heart. It was a great ball club. And on to other matters. Meanwhile, you know, as they say, we want to have to come to the issue of poor reporting, poor journalism in Canada. And, of course, U.S. journalists don't care, but we should be caring a lot. We have a very odd situation. A few months back, the Premier of Ontario jumped out in front of everybody and said, okay, I'm going to cut off the electricity to upstate New York because of the tariffs. And that lasted about 24 hours. And then he said, maybe that was a mistake. And so I thought maybe he would learn because we have a problem about now that we should emulate the Jays. So we should get our act together. We have a prime minister, and he represents the country in matters of foreign affairs, and trade and such comes under his aegis. And I thought we learned that because everybody said, well, okay, there's a little bit of a misstep. Of course, we also have Alberta, which is just waiting to do something ignorant, the premier. Both, by the way, basically Trumpists, people of the right who were pretty happy to get Donald Trump in, but then they found out he can step on your toes too. The point is that we had this situation, and everybody said, okay, let's be Team Canada. Let's pull ourselves together. We're Team Canada. Carney is the prime minister, and he's a conservative, so everybody ought to be happy. And they would have their meeting, and even the unions were invited to sit quietly by. And then this problem arises again, that for reasons known to him, the premier decided he would get a $75 million ad placed for the Super Bowl or whatever. No, pardon me, the World Series. We're coming to the Super Bowl. Maybe somebody should just call him right now and say, don't buy any ads to the Super Bowl, all right? At any rate, people have fallen. I don't know. I'm really surprised. There are people, even of the left, I looked around, I noticed, who thought he had done something wonderful when he set up this ad saying that Ronald Reagan didn't like tariffs and that he wanted to remind Trump, and Trump should know this, that our good friend Reagan did not believe in tariffs. And, well, putting this under the label of journalism, they haven't reported to us how this strange thing happened, because, first of all, the ad appeared, and everybody knows that Trump behaved like Trump, and it has actually caused a problem. That is, negotiations, I assume, are real, and preparations and planning and elements of the deal are discussed, how you might trade this thing off for the other thing, et cetera. I assume it's fairly expensive to do that, by the way. So at any rate, that got knocked in a cocked hat. And the premier told us he was proud of himself. And as I said, some people even on the left here applauded him for doing this. But then we get into a situation where we learn from the American newspapers or from Trump's mouth that Prime Minister Carney has apologized to Trump for that little kerfuffle. And so who is responsible? Well, let's put it this way. First of all, he says that the mistake was made, but there's no accounting for how it happened. And we're told the second person to speak up was the premier, and he said, well, I ran it by the prime minister. And they permitted us to think that the prime minister had signed off on it, saying, yeah, oh, go ahead. Now the prime minister says, no, I didn't sign off on it. I recommended they not run it. And so he says, the premiers are telling us a somewhat different story, and they're shading it. Each one is kind of explaining himself, and the media is not actually trying to pin it down. What does it mean to say, if you say, I got his approval, that would mean he says, oh, good for you. That's really smart, Doug. Go ahead and do it. That would be approval. But what is it to say, I ran it by him, or he saw it? Well, if he saw it, did you show it to him so he could say no, or did you say, I'm doing this? What kind of a mess of a political process do we have that the premier and the prime minister are monkeying around with an ad that may knock everything sideways? And where is the victory in any of this, or where is the big gain? And the other thing is, watching it, is that the premier says it was a big success, and that he's proud of it, and he said, if I was, I'm not going to roll over like everybody else. He said, I did that because, you know, somebody has to stand up to the guy. Well, yeah, but he rolled over. He pulled the ad. So what kind of malarkey is this? He says, yeah, I'm rough and tough, so I stand up. I fight back. Well, no, you don't. You pulled it. Do you understand? And if it was so smart, Why didn't you go extra innings with that one? Why didn't you say, okay, I'm buying a new ad now. Now I'm running a rootin' tootin' new ad. I'm going to really show them. You don't believe that at all. You backed off. And by the way, so did British Columbia. We forgot about them. British Columbia also bought an ad. In this case, it's a Social Democrat, right, Mr. Eby? He, too, backed off his ad after saying he wasn't going to. So it's kind of like a house full of kids. You can't get them to go to bed. It's like they keep popping out of the bedroom and running down the hall. This is bizarre. Who's in charge of the blasted country has to be the question. And it would have to be shown, and it better be shown soon. And all we have is ideologically driven journalism. They're not trying to get to the bottom of any of this, or asking sharper questions. If that was such a great idea, why did you pull the ad? You pulled it. Don't say that you're a fighter. You apparently set off a firecracker on Trump's front lawn, and then you ran home. And probably we ought to remove the word fight. Fighting is a long way from buying an ad. And let's put everybody in the loop. I remember a few years ago, Unifor had a leader, Jerry Dias, and he bought an ad attacking the big three for taking jobs to Mexico. And that was a Super Bowl ad. It didn't make a nickel's worth of difference. And again, it's not fighting. We have to put it in the category of whining. This is just whining. It's not anything significant being accomplished. But the big question, and by the way, today's papers are all full of editorials. We all got to be like the Blue Jays. You know, it's united the country. It doesn't look united to me. It looks very much like an ad hoc operation. And really, it's the job, and I would say it falls to the prime minister to make up his mind. Because this is, frankly, you have to have a little discipline. You know, if the manager says, you're on first base, stay there, wait, we have a plan to get you to second, and then you don't run off and try to steal second. Do what the plan says to do. And we have at the moment this grandstanding by second echelon players. And let's talk about the content. By the way, in the case of Ford, I went to his Twitter, and he says something about being proud of his. He wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post. But the Washington Post doesn't like Donald Trump, so actually he's just playing on one side of the American political scene when he does that. But he wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post, and he says, you can read it here. You click here. So I clicked there. Well, it's a paywall. I couldn't read it. Actually, I wasn't able to find it. Why didn't the Star, Sun, Globe, CBC, others, why don't they make it available? The Premier of Ontario has written a chest-thumping essay about how to run North America. And couldn't we just share that with everybody? Isn't it important? I have to go through a Washington Post paywall to read it. It's somewhat absurd. By the way, on that one, I have to go by stories of what, you know, the journalist telling me, which I always hate, somebody summarizing the remarks of a major speech, and they sum it up, and they tend to forget things. But if you go to the content of his position, it should be we should be appalled that we have a premier who poses as a presidential historian, and is an authority on American presidents. he has said that Reagan was either the greatest or one of the greatest presidents in American history, and that he was a good guy and better than Trump because he was for free trade. Let's see. So Ronald Reagan, he's the one who really stood out as the most right-wing modern American president. And he did it in the way that Trump tends to do things, by picking enemies, targets, and then mugging them. And he fired the air controllers of the United States. Every major airport in America he fired the air controllers. They had a union and they wanted to go on strike. So he didn't play around. He didn't order them back or whatever. He fired them. So this is Doug is telling us what a great president. Ronald Reagan was the president at the time of the AIDS disaster, when thousands and thousands of Americans died from AIDS and were dying. And there was a call from every quarter, where there's a conscience, to put money into research on an urgent basis to find a cure and a treatment. And Ronald Reagan did not support it. Ronald Reagan did not support it. He went years not even wanting to discuss the subject. It was, and by the way, very rare that even at press conferences anyone asked about it. But they did begin to ask. And when they did, they got really ignorant, bigoted, horrible answers from a smart-aleck press officer who would make fun of the guy asking, hinting something obscene about him. It was just unspeakable. There's a book, and I think it was turned into a film, and the band played on. Here's our problem. We keep forgetting all these things. So I'm glad that Doug decided to nominate Reagan as a great president, just so we could know how much Doug knows. He also invaded Grenada because he felt like it, and Clint Eastwood made a completely a ridiculous film about it, if you want to know about that. Invaded Grenada when it was no U.S. business at all. It was, and there had been a change of government, and so the U.S. decided to invade, and they showed off their power. Reagan did it. He and Thatcher, neither of them. Thatcher had a remote legal link in it. Grenada is part of the Commonwealth, and so they just cobbled together a scheme to overthrow the government of Grenada and kill some Cubans who were there building an airport and helping with the infrastructure, because the reason they invaded, because it was a socialist government trying to raise a standard of living and increase the prospects of every Grenadian. Reagan invaded. He also bombed Libya. I don't know if Doug knows that, but he's an historian, so I assume he does know it. The U.S. bombed Libya, and it was a targeted attack on Muammar Gaddafi. Many years before Hillary and her friends did it, Ronald Reagan set the bar, and they blew up parts of the home of Muammar Gaddafi, who wasn't in the home because, as part of the Gaddafi story, he wanted to live in traditional way, more like most of the people of Libya had lived. He had a tent near his home, where most of the family was. But he wasn't, so he wasn't in the building that got hit. And a child was killed there, there was more than one, but he had an adopted daughter. And there was a press conference of the Reagan cohort boasting of what they had done. And, of course, they had failed on the mission. The mission was to murder Gaddafi. But they thought, so reporters were a little tough. So the reporter said, well, you just blew up his home and you killed his adopted daughter. Does that bother you? And all the macho guys couldn't wait to get to the microphone. The first one there said, oh, we didn't see any adoption papers. And everybody laughed. So, yeah, that's the greatest president. When he launched his campaign to become the Republican nominee for president, it was the official launch, he chose a southern town. Ronald Reagan chose a southern town where three civil rights workers had been murdered. And people said, wow, you seem to be kind of, don't you have a problem with that? And they said, no, it's, we're campaigning in the South. And so we're here. And we're not supposed to say the only reason you're there is that's where the Klan and the police, they were the same, killed those civil rights workers. And, oh, really? This is the way they play. And this, by the way, it's the way Trump plays. This idea that I know that Trump is about as bad as he can get, but his godfather was Ronald Reagan. Trump entered into Republican politics when Ronald Reagan ran. Reagan was an outlier, just like Trump. He was an outlier. What made him powerful and potentially big for the Republicans was that he was a Hollywood guy. He had a Hollywood name. He did a lot of very important commercials that enriched him. But he came with very right-wing credentials when he got into it. And this man, I only know his name as Stone, but Stone was one of the Reagan operatives on the West Coast. And so when Reagan wanted to get backing in the East, Stone called one of the most notorious villains in American history, Roy Cohn, and said, Roy, we got to have some support in the East. We got a lot of support out West because, Ron's a cowboy and a Hollywood star and got support in the West. But we need, some people with serious money back East. And so he said, when you come to New York, go to the Trump family. By the way, he didn't mean Donald. He was talking about Donald's dad. He said, old man Trump, he'll back you. So Stone went to the offices of the Trump operation, and he said he came into the executive area, and Donald was there, and Donald said, so what do you want with my dad? What's up? What's going on? And he said, well, we're looking for support for Reagan. He says, tell me about it. So he said he told Trump, Donald, at that time, junior to the old man Trump, and he laid out the Reagan case, and Trump said, okay, count me in. He says, you're going to talk to my dad, but I want in. I'm going to be part of this. So that's why when our premier lectures Trump about Reagan, he's talking right straight into the face of a Reaganite. And the idea that Reagan had any permanent or solid point of view is absurd. Reagan was as good at hypocrisy and double talk as any other politician. He didn't have a firm opinion about anything. Now, which brings us to another thing. Tariffs. Does Doug oppose? He's a free trader. He thinks that that free trade's away and that tariffs are damaging. Why then does he support 100% tariffs on Chinese electrical vehicles? Why? How come he never got upset and said, "Hey, this no, that's really not, that's not good for business." You know, these tariffs. No, they all in favor of him. And I understand. And again, I have to say, everybody talks about what he said without being able to read it, most of it. he when he goes after the subject of Trump or. I would start to say Putin. Well, stick with Trump and China. His position is he wants to be part of Fortress America along with Donald. He wants to be his best buddy. That's why he's so frustrated that he keeps getting a hand in his face or is tripped as he goes out the door. He can't figure that out because he's a loving, ideological, hugging supporter of Trumpism. But the problem is that Trump is, that's Americanism. And we're finding out that Canada's not included in Americanism. That's unless they choose to lay down like a doormat and say, let's hear that 51st state proposition again. But at the moment, Trump is finding there is a country, China, that didn't come calling when he said, "Everybody come in if you don't want tariffs. Come, come, come. Line up at the door." And they did. You want to look at a bunch of lackeys. Everybody showed up and started saying, "We'll give you this, we'll give you that." But China didn't come. And they're the ones who have the position that Doug claims he has. They're the ones who said, "Look, we have free trade, World Trade Organization. We have rules, and you got to play by those rules in order for us to do business. You can't reach in your pocket and pull out national security on us, and then mess up our trade that is fair trade going on between states to keep all of us somewhat." With our heads above water, if you're going to start this trade stuff, a war, it might lead to the real thing, and it is China that insists on that. But Doug has an upside down view of the world, and this love for Ronald business going on. He ought to. At the end of the day, what we're saying is premiers ought to be premiers, and the prime minister ought to be the prime minister. And the question is, do we have a system in which the prime minister can exercise actual authority? Because, again, we have a premier telling us one story. We have the prime minister telling us another one. The premier doesn't say, "Yeah, I made a mistake. I got to stop doing it." Instead, he actually pretends that he achieved something when we got kicked in the shins because of it. And the prime minister looks, it doesn't look like a tiger, because when he says, "Well, I apologized to Trump," is one thing I think Canadians really don't want to hear is that the prime minister apologized because we didn't create this trade war. It's been very awkward and damaging, and it looks like it will continue to do so. And therefore, we have we're locked into this question of how a federal system works here. But clearly, and I guess I started on the point of journalism, I'm not seeing any real live journalism. I'm not seeing anybody wanting to know anything. They tell us he said, and then speaking of China, she said, and then Carney said, but they're not telling us, not pursuing it and questioning what's kind of relationship. And I would look right at the one of, "We showed it to the prime minister." What does that mean? And did you ask for permission to buy the ad, that kind of thing. And I would urge the journalists to do that. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. If we have The Town Bully by Mr. Ledbetter, we could play that. And we'll come back and we'll talk about solving the problems that I was laying out in the first portion of this program.
I'm looking for that bully, baby, bully of the town. Looking for that bully, but that bully can't be found. Well, I'm looking for that bully of the town. When I walk this levee round, 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 every day I may be found. When I walk this levee round, well, I'm looking for that bully of the town. Looking for that bully mama, bully of the town. Looking for that bully, but that bully can't be found. Well, I'm looking for that bully of the town. Looking for that bully mama, bully of the town. Looking for that bully that shot the woman down. Well, I'm looking for that bully of the town. When I walk this levee round,
that's Ledbelly. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM / donate. You can start now. We're going to be going out and going at it in on the 17th of the month, but you can now, anytime you like, go to CIUT.fm and donate. Kindly mention the Taylor Report. Before we want to talk about the changing political climate in the U.S., which should is kind of important to us because I think we've had just about much Trump as we can take for this period, and we're hoping to see American people fighting for equality and their rights and to protect people from cruelty, frankly. The way the Trump administration delivers its policies is there's now a it's laced with cruelty, and that is a I don't want to use the old fashioned words about how far right you can get and what that is, but it's the problem of our class differences and oppression of people based on their identities. It's always been a rancorous and unpleasant aspect of North American, but particularly U.S. culture. And the Trump philosophy approach now feels, now notices that they are more popular in significant circles of America if the more cruel they are. So if you say, oh, my goodness, that family has been torn apart. That poor child is being put in a cage with this. Oh, my goodness, you know, those people are drowning. There is a laughing, chuckling, reactionary element of society, and it's not small, who that's what they want to see. So if you talk about these things, that is something that they appreciate. And so Trump and his Secretary of War go out of their way to, you know, push the envelope or tear it up and do cruel things, particularly, I mean, in the case recent case off Venezuela, killing people who are not even known or identified except by them because they're they like to play sheriff, and Dirty Harry type sheriff. By the way, Dirty Harry stuff has been with us. Dirty Harry is a good sort of cultural embodiment of what's going on. I raise all this because I recently saw a short piece by Diana Johnson, who was on our show a couple of weeks ago. She's a very brilliant American writer. She was a and handled public, I call it public relations, publicity for the Green Party when it was Green Party years back was an environmental party trying to, you know, fight. I don't know if you heard about this. You used to say there was global warming. Nobody says it anymore because it's more true than ever, but it's now been set aside by all of our conservative leaders. And at any rate, that was a party that had a lot of promise, and Diana Johnson was a big part of that, and she's written books about it. And so at any rate, she's written a comment on what she thinks are the failings of American liberals, her favorite target, and it's very timely, particularly in light of what's going on in New York City, that there be a challenge to the Democratic Party leadership. And so she wrote about the No Kings demonstrations. And the big thing there was that the No Kings demonstration, which was, you know, smart politics, but it had a lot of big money behind it. And it would be money that wants to bring back Biden, Is, or Obama, or the Carter family. And so she's very worried about this. And so here's what she wrote. This is Diana Johnson. What's wrong with the No Kings demonstrations is not the billionaire funding. That funding simply helps to confirm what was obvious from the beginning. The problem is that this is a massive channeling of a legitimate discontent away from clarification of the issues toward voting for the Democratic Party. The Trump regime is absolutely ghastly, and there should be big protests, but this isn't it. It's astroturfing on behalf of Nancy Pelosi and company. Whoever paid for it, this has all the earmarks of a professionally organized color revolution. Organizers are disputing which color to use, purple or yellow, to exploit and control authentic popular discontent to achieve its own purposes. The slogan No Kings seems particularly irrelevant and childish. The restoration of monarchy is hardly the burning issue of the day. Kings and royalty are associated with stability, dignity, tradition, qualities that are the exact opposite of the vulgar Trump. I get to make sure I find myself here, right? The vulgar Trump gangster boss style. If anything, the result of recent Democratic elections declining from mediocre to horrific should comfort royalists. No Kings seem to have been selected as a bland, consensual theme that avoids genuine issues. The main issues being ignored have to do with Trump's war policy, almost as if the protesters believed in Trump's claim to be the champion of peace and deals, peace deals. Forget about Trump's support for Netanyahu's genocidal destruction of Gaza, the U.S. bombing of Iran, the military buildup, find it again. Why not to read from a phone? The buildup for regime change, war in Venezuela, threats of war with China, of the dangerous vacillating arming of Ukraine. Films show No Kings demonstrators carrying signs declaring that Russia is our enemy. Thus, if Trump, in the midst of his arrogant hostility to Venezuela, Palestine, Iran, and China, strikes poses about making peace with Putin as advertising for his egomaniac campaign to win the Nobel Peace Prize, then Trump's enemies prefer war. The United States desperately needs an opposition that seeks to educate the public, not merely cater to hostility to one particular repugnant individual. If these protests evolve into a serious political movement, I'll be very happy to have been mistaken. That's Diana Johnson. I think she's right, and we all are watching New York closely, aren't we? Mr. Mamdani is sort of what Diana's talking about. And we should know that New York State has two senators in the United States Senate, and neither has endorsed Mamdani. So we're getting a division in the House of the Democrats, and that's a very good thing. And it's the Hillary and Bill faction, and the Biden people, as far as I know, are not supporting Mamdani. And you know something? That's a plus. In the last 24, 48 hours, there's been a number of prominent Democrats who have halfway decent reputations, not that they deserve them, but have decided to now say that they do support Mamdani. I would say that isn't helping him, because actually people like him because he's not those guys. The idea that the Democrats' leadership tends to have is the masses of people have no choice but us, that the gang that created the debacle for Biden. They think that they are in charge of the whole place, debacle after debacle after debacle. The Mamdani phenomena, a man who calls himself a socialist and actually has programs that are absolutely appropriate and should be expected of anybody claiming to be a socialist. He's advocating for New York, and he does it with panache. And that's another thing that's dead in American politics. There is no panache. Everybody has 10 speechwriters, and then they have three advisors to tell them which of the four or five draft speeches the person should read, and underlining where they're supposed to put the emphasis in their words. It's just a miserable thing to watch. But now the problem that Diana Johnson was addressing is before us, and wouldn't you know, when you have, somebody once said, when you have a problem, there's also an answer built into the problem. So don't be afraid of it. The problem brings with it the answer. We'll see where this goes. I was alluding to the fact that Obama, former President Obama, has semi-endorsed. I don't really appreciate even his words. I guess, you know, Mamdani had no choice but to say, oh, thanks, nice to talk to you. Obama called him. I don't know which politician is being built up here. It strikes me that Obama is just scratching to get a little credibility back after what happened in his administration, where so much promise was wasted and never delivered upon. But the Democratic Party seems to be trying. Let me go to what my complaint about him. He said he admired Mamdani and that he was impressed with his campaign. And he said if he was elected, he would be happy to be a sounding board for Mamdani. So lucky Mamdani, if he gets elected mayor, the former president says he'll be happy to be a sounding board. That's not a ringing endorsement. It seems to be suggesting if you get that job, you have to call me. And again, I didn't, and Mamdani didn't throw his hat in the air and say, oh, golly, I got that endorsement. I think he knows that that's actually a problem for him, because the socialist element or the people attracted to the program that he's put forward know that they wouldn't get it from anybody else but him. And when they hear about Obama calling up, and it was not an endorsement. I mean, it was a sideways thing in which he said, "I'll be your sounding board." And so, of course, again, you know, you can't look a gift horse in the mouth, right? So, okay, thanks a lot for the saying that you admire my campaign. That's not a ringing endorsement he got from, and it, I guess it wasn't a ringing thank you either. Those who are creating, the forces that are creating this new wave of left-wing politics through the Democratic Party, the most awkward political maze existing, the ones who are doing that have to be worried that the Democratic Party is going to put its arm around them and embrace them, because that's a good way to be killed off. And I think it's like a crisis waiting to happen. But at the end of the day, I would say again, we hope that Mamdani comes through big. He certainly exposed all the phony capitalist politicians in New York City. He's made them all look ridiculous, while being a kind of a swell guy. And that is his best trick. Because, you know, when Cuomo tries to play the heavy, long-faced former governor and speaking in a heavy, knowledgeable voice, he looks ridiculous. And Mamdani smiles, makes intelligent and caring responses, and wins people over. So we will know. Next week we'll be talking about what happened, I assume. But to go now, one other point to go back to what Diana Johnson wrote. She said, people at the demonstrations called No Kings, they said Russia is our, you know, we have to fight Russia. These are liberal Democrats. That's the scary part of American politics. And in the case of Mr. Eby in British Columbia, I saw his ad, the ad that they took out, and it said, Canadian, I'm going to have to paraphrase it. But basically what it said was that Russia is the winner in the lumber. Yeah, due to the lumber tariffs, Russia is the winner. So Mr. Eby wants us to say, see, I'm going to be against Russia, and your guy Trump, he's for Russia. And the same goes true of Doug Ford, except that makes the enemy China. All of which brings me now, I realize, to the last point, which is an article appeared in the Saturday Globe and Mail by Eric Regula, who covers, he's been one of the most established writers at the Globe for many years. And the title of his piece is Chinese EV Investments Buoy Hungary's Economy. They could do the same for Canada. And I would say thank you, Mr. Regula, for opening the door to very important new thinking outside the Trump box. That is that Hungary is now building plants. They have made a deal with Chinese automakers to build battery plants and plants to produce Chinese vehicles, which are doing well in Europe, you see. And his point really is, why don't we do that? And there's really only two things standing in the way. One thing is Trump, but the other is ideology. And he doesn't speak to that, but I would say his idea, we've remarked on this on the Taylor Report, others are starting to say the obvious. Chinese make good cars. They have companies that would be willing to invest. And so the auto industry wouldn't die. It would just be different, a new big investor. By the way, one that's better than the other guys produces better cars than the big three. And they would be willing to open production here. So what's in the way? And what's in the way is ideology, politics, the Cold War. And the Chinese have said, and Hungary agrees with them. Hungary is a member of NATO, by the way. So you have to overcome your Cold War thinking. And what Diana Johnson was speaking to, we're speaking to, is that the Democratic Party and all the political parties of Canada are so ideologically locked in that there's no oxygen, and they're frozen, and they don't. And you would have to overcome Cold War ideology in order to have a healthy economy. And so we need a twofer. We need to overcome Cold War ideology, and we need to talk serious business with Chinese businesses who are ready, willing to enter into agreements with us. And I would put a footnote, we have to become a trustworthy partner. Trump has a reputation now as not being trustworthy. I would say after Huawei, other countries would say, listen, you want us to put a lot of dough in here, but then you play little games with us. All, by the way, those are ideological games. So if we're going to become a healthy economy and be led by sensible people, we have to overcome our prejudices, and particularly the Cold War mentality. It has to be thrown out the window. Hungary is doing that. Hungary is a member of NATO. Why don't we talk more to them? Oh, I know. There's a little ideological reason, but throw that in the garbage. They're going to get ahead because they now are looking after themselves and not worried about whether Brussels is happy. And Canada has to become the same, go the same way. I think we're about to that point. Steve Fruitman is in the house. It's 78. It's been a long time. I don't play the Steve does. Pedro, as usual, has been patient and efficient. Thank you very much. This is Taylor Report. See you next week.